Hello, good evening, everyone. It's so good to see you here. It's my total pleasure to introduce our amazing speakers tonight. To my right, we have Dr. Gail Iles, some of you might have seen her before. Thank you for joining us. She's joined us a couple of times here at ScienceWorks, and we're thrilled to have her back again to talk about human spaceflight, because in one of the many things that she has done in her career is be an astronaut trainer, and she has actually has the world record for number of hours experimenting on the parabolic flight in zero gravity. Is that right?
Not quite.
Not
but
nearly.
I'll take it
nearly.
For this evening.
Okay, we'll get you to tell us about that in a second. And then on the end we have Andrea Boyd and Andrea is here. All the way from Germany, which is really exciting, although you'll be able to tell from her accent that she is actually an Aussie woman. And so I think she's pretty happy to be back in Australia, apart from how cold it is. And Andrea is a flight controller for the ISS, the International Space Station. We're so excited to hear more about that. So just to get started, maybe I'll get you both to sort of introduce yourselves by giving us like a quick explanation of your roles that have been involved human spaceflight, because I know you're both incredibly accomplished women and you've done so many things, but you've both been working in human spaceflight at different times. So maybe Gail, do you want to start and tell us about your roles in human spaceflight?
Sure. So the International Space Station is the main platform at the moment where we're sending astronauts to. And the International Space Station is a project that is a conglomeration of five big partners: the Americans, Russians, Canadians, Japanese, and Europeans. And the astronauts who all go to the ISS need to have training on all of the different components of the ISS. So they go to all of those five different places as part of their training. And that might take up to 2 years. So they'll start in America, then they'll come across to Europe, and they'll go to all the different places. So when I was an astronaut instructor, which is a very cool job title, by the way, I would have all of the expedition crews would come through the European Astronaut Center, and we would train them how to operate the European parts of the ISS. Now, the ISS is just a big laboratory where we can do lots of very cool scientific experiments. And the Columbus Laboratory is the European one. So we would train all of the astronauts, so the Americans, the Europeans, the Canadians, and they would all come through us, and we would show them how to operate the different parts. And that's what I did. So my
so fun.
Most famous student was Chris Hatfield.
Woo! Awesome.
And he gave me a gold star for my lessons. So I'm very proud of that.
Well, that's pretty good. All right. Andrea, can you tell us a bit about your background?
Yeah, so I'm Andrea. I work as a flight controller at the European Astronaut Center. We changed over about 7 years ago. Gail flew here and immigrated, and I emigrated the other way. Originally from Adelaide. And my day job is in mission control. So, you know, when the astronauts call down and you hear a voice from Earth that answers back, that's my day job. So I'm talking to the astronauts and running all of the different payloads and different systems and engineering stuff that goes on in the Columbus module for the European side of the station. So when they call Europe, they get this Adelaide accent.
So you, like, just hang out talking to astronauts, being like, how's it hanging? And they're like, we're not hanging, we're floating. And you're like, whatever. Yeah, cool. All right. People keep talking about going to Mars. People are very excited about human spaceflight. We're very excited about exploring our solar system and the universe. And Mars has been in the news a lot. We keep hearing things about Elon Musk's plan to go to Mars or other people's plan to go to Mars. But it's really not that simple, is it? And so maybe, Gail, can you tell us a bit about the steps that we have to do before we get to Mars?
Yeah, so getting to Mars, in case you weren't aware, it would take about 9 months to travel to Mars. And that's just to get there. And then you need to get there and do something, take some photos, a few selfies, that kind of thing. And then you've got to come back. That's another 9 months. That's just silly. What we need to be doing is going to the moon. And in fact, that's what's happening. So we have plans already in place. NASA are developing what's called the Lunar Orbital Platform. And this is another space station is going to go in orbit around the moon, and then we're going to send astronauts, instead of just to the International Space Station, which is really, really close in space terms, we're going to send them all the way to go in orbit around the moon, and then they'll dock with this new lunar orbital platform. And from there, they can do some really cool science. But what we don't know, well, we know a little bit from the Apollo landings. We know that there's an awful lot of very nasty radiation up there, and we really, really, really need to take good care of the astronauts that we send up, and we need to protect them very well, both with their spacesuits and also with the materials that we use in the spacecraft, and that's what I'm interested in. And so if we're going to go to Mars, and that would be in many decades' time, then we're going to have to do it step by step, and we're going to start with the moon.
And so so can you tell us about this deep space gateway? So that's orbiting the moon, yeah. And the idea is that from there, yeah. Eventually when we get to go to Mars, that will kind of we'll use that as a sort of leap-off point.
That's right. So the deep space gateway has now been renamed a couple of months ago to this lunar orbital platform. And it's going to serve a number of purposes. So we're going to have astronauts living on it, doing their science in orbit around the moon. We're going to look at landing people onto the moon again and trying to get them back up off it, because that's a huge technological challenge. And then we're going to do some science as well in that unique environment. And then from there, we'll develop traveling to the Mars. The Mars.
Yeah, so at my work, we're specifically looking at a moon village, so looking at really a community and going back to the moon to stay. So we have a whole division at my work downstairs, and they are looking at really interesting things that you can do with the moon and how you can better use energy. So how can you use the dust on the top of the moon is called regolith. How can you use energy, the regolith for energy storage, or how can you chuck it in a 3D printer that can handle different size particles and then, you know, print out the habitat that you're going to live in for extra protection. And we're actually building a training habitat for the astronauts to train in outside my window. So I'm getting a great view of that. It's not finished construction. I can't show photos yet. But we're building this giant 30-metre dome as part of the astronaut new training facilities. And it's two-thirds full of lunar regolith simulant that we developed with some students, actually, that came and they studied geology. And then they figured out how to make a lunar, like, really close to the lunar soil. And so two-thirds full of that with a crane on the top so it attaches to the astronaut spacesuit so they can jump around like they're on the moon as well for the training.
So you're really simulating what it would be like on the moon, both from the lower gravity that the moon has.
And from the really annoying dust that gets in everything and causes
and
a ton of problems.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Wow, okay. All right. And I love it that you, like, that's happening right outside your window. You're like, oh, maybe I'll just, like, wander in and, like, go to the moon. You're probably not allowed to do that. Gail, you touched on this earlier. Like, space is, it's not a very friendly environment for humans. Can I just get a sense from the audience? Can you just put your hand up if you want to go to space? Like, who would be up for that? I mean, I would, yeah. Yeah, okay. So most people here, they're willing to go up. But I've got some bad news for you. It's really bad for your health. Andrea, you know a lot about this, about what happens to astronauts' bodies when they go into space. Can you tell us a little bit about that? It's a bit gross, but...
Yeah, you know. So I'm actually a mechatronic engineer, and I chose that because I really like programming computers and working with robots and not working with the human body. But as you find out in life, you never stop learning and going back to school effectively. So I was asked to cross-train to do a dual role on console. So I'm not just Eurocom anymore. I'm also the biomedical engineer. And I had to train with the doctors and the surgeons and in the hospital and learn all of that and learn what happens to your body in space. And it's gross. So first up, you see when the astronauts first get into orbit, they get like space sickness. And that's because your neurovestibular system just goes, you know, you need three signals to be able to have your balance and not feel sick like you do on a roller coaster sometimes or a ship.
So this is the thing in your ear
is,
that tells you which way is down.
Yeah, that's one of them. So you need the fluid in your ear to be stable. You need a horizon and you need a point of contact. And you go to space and suddenly you've got none of three. So your brain just can't figure out these signals. Most astronauts get quite sick for a couple of days. And then your brain just disregards all those signals and says, nope, that's rubbish. And we'll continue on and be fine without it. And then you're good from that perspective until we come back down to Earth and then you get it all over again. But then you know, you see the astronauts the first 2 weeks, they've got these really puffy rugby player faces with chicken legs because you don't have the fluids in your body with gravity like you usually do. So the fluids have all shifted up, and, you know, suddenly you've got most of it in your head and around that area. And then, interestingly, the pressure sensors for figuring out how much blood you need in your body are up here in your carotid artery. So they're suddenly like, oh, no, we've got too much. And normally you have about 8 litres of blood in your body and you can lose 2 litres before you die. But in space, suddenly the pressure sensors saying how much do you need are like, nope, too much. So they get rid of about 1.5 litres. And suddenly you've only... That's why getting cut in space is quite serious because you can only lose about 500 millilitres before it's fatal, which is not so nice.
So and astronauts then, have 1.5 litres less blood.
Yep.
On average,
yes,
us.
Absolutely. Wow. So the first thing when they come back down to make sure that they're not fainting all the time is they go in a medical tent and get 1.5 litres of IV put back in to help solve that problem. But then, yeah, it's quite like there's so many different things that happen in your heart muscles atrophy a bit because you don't need as much effort to pump everything around. Because you have less fluid, then the hydrostatic pressure in your blood vessels has changed and suddenly your body says, okay, to equalise it out, let's make less red blood cells. So you've got less blood to carry oxygen, less oxygen-carrying red blood cells. And, it's not so great. And then your bones have a really interesting thing that happens as well. So every day your bones remodel themselves and you don't even notice it, but this happens. So your top layer gets sort of microfractures and then the top layer kind of comes off, mostly like calcium, a few other things. And then if you put loading on it, so just I'm standing in a chair, I'm picking up the microphone, I've put loading on the bones and you get a nice new layer come back on. And your bones constantly do this every day. If you jump around a lot, then they'll do it a lot more. You'll have great, healthy bones. Then in space, you can't get that. So we had to figure out ways of making this happen for the astronauts in space.
Yeah, so maybe just briefly tell us a little bit about what astronauts have to do, like when they're on the ISS, for example, to make sure that they don't lose all that bone density.
You have to work out for 2.5 hours every day on the space station. So you do about an hour of cardio, either on the treadmill, which is great for this, you know, loading on your bones, especially the big leg ones, and then an hour on this amazing all-in-one gym machine called the Advanced Resistive Exercise Device, and then either the treadmill, as I said, which is good, or the bicycle. So you have to do a cardio one and then the resistive all-in-one weights machine. And we found by doing that, we don't have any muscle loss anymore. Most of the astronauts are more buff after they've been in space than when they launch, because they work out for so many hours every day. And that keeps them all healthy and it countermeasures all of those effects that I mentioned and keeps them all below the clinical horizon.
Two and a half hours of exercise a day and they're pretty good. All right, so we've solved a lot.